Noah Webster, the father of American English, thought language could be an instrument of patriotism and unification. Jill Lepore, author of A is for American, says one of Noah Webster's first plans to unite Americans was a new system of simplified spelling.
He felt quite passionately as a political thinker that Americans lacked national distinctions, that what bound Americans to one another in terms of heritage and habits and just general cultural traits was inadequate, because the only things that bound Americans to one another in the 1780s and 1790s when Webster was writing were things that they shared with people in England. So Webster felt pretty strongly that the way that Americans would kind of learn to be American was if they were introduced to almost artificial national distinctions. And so one of those artificial national distinctions he thought would be useful would be to cultivate an American language. And one way to do that would be to introduce, quite deliberately, spelling differences between English spelling and American spelling.
But, of course, in addition to that, he was also fascinated by language. I mean, you point a rather funny portrait of Webster, as a matter of fact. He seems to have been, is eccentric a good word for him?
Well, that might be a generous word for him, I guess. I mean, he was certainly a quirky kind of guy, but he was a pedant. I mean, he's the kind of guy you really wish you're glad you never had to know, or certainly you're glad you didn't have him as a sophomore English teacher in high school. I mean, he was a very self-important man. One of my favorite stories about Webster is in this tract in which he claimed that nothing united the United States more than a cobweb. He later came to see that tract, which was published in 1785, as the first proposal for a constitution. And later in his life, he wrote to James Madison and said, "Don't you remember that actually the Constitution was my idea?" And he kind of wanted it known to posterity that Webster was, if not the author of the Constitution, at least the originator of the idea, which is just patently false. But Webster wanted to think of himself as a hugely important American. And Madison, to his credit, wrote a very politic letter in reply saying, "Well, you know, all great ideas have their origins in many different men." So, you know, Madison quite single-handedly, as the drafter of the Constitution, was quite generous to Webster, but many of his contemporaries were not so generous. Jefferson called Webster a self-exalted pedagogue, and that's kind of the view of him that comes through in his papers when you read through his letters and diaries.
Now, the funny thing about this, in a way, is you make him sound like a man that none of us would want not only to have as a teacher, but not even really to have as a friend, and yet he was extraordinarily important in the development of American language.
Yeah, he really was important. I think that not a lot of people dispute Webster's great influence on the American language. It's really quite unusual for a single person to have such an effect. But one of the things that Europeans, especially Englishmen and women, when they traveled to the United States, say in the 1830s or so, would always remark on is that when they came to the United States, they could travel from Boston to Charleston to Chicago, and they could understand anything anyone was saying. And in fact, everyone seemed to talk alike. Whereas they felt that, you know, you could walk 10 miles outside of London and you couldn't understand the person that you were talking to. That the range of accent and dialect within England, especially with all of, obviously, throughout Britain, was so great as to be almost incomprehensible from one part of the country to another. But that wasn't the case in America, a much vaster region, that you could travel the United States and everyone really spoke pretty similarly. And most people credit that with Webster's spelling book and it's his guide to pronunciation. I mean, the whole spelling, he thought spelling was important so that when you read a letter or read a newspaper, you'd know if it was written by an American, if they didn't use the U in honor. But he really thought pronunciation was important, that we should all speak alike so that we wouldn't make fun of one another, so that we would feel like we were all part of the same project.
How did he accomplish this, though? And who gave him the support that he needed in order for this unification of the language to take place?
Well, he really, you know, he did do an awful lot of traveling within the United States. And one thing that he did, whenever he went to a town, he would bring copies of his spelling book with his guide to pronunciation and all of his guides to spelling, and he would give them to free to the town's printer, or, you know, in a city, or to all the different publishers in the city, and say, "Use this when you need to spell a word." So he understood that he was living in an age where the printing press, which is still relatively new and which is really important and is the main producer of communication, he understood that if he could get a copy of his spelling book to every printer in America, that he could ensure that all newspapers and everything that was printed would be spelled in the way that he wanted it to be spelled. And if American school children all over the country would learn to read and learn to articulate using his spelling book, that he could have a pretty big effect on a nation that was relying on this single media. And he was wise to know that those strategies would have that kind of an impact.
He was a more practical man than you'd expect in some ways, reading about him. There have been a number of attempts over the years to simplify spelling. This wasn't the first, and it certainly hasn't been the last. But he did seem to understand that there were things he could do and things he couldn't.
Yeah, well, it's not just that he was a pragmatist, which he certainly was, but it wasn't a philosophical or a philological intervention that he was making. It was purely a political one. It didn't matter to him if his spelling didn't actually make sense, if he would spell some words one way and by a rule of metaphor you'd spell another word a different way. It didn't matter to him if he was inconsistent. It just mattered that it did the political work that was necessary. And that's pretty different from a lot of his contemporaries who were much more interested from a philosophical point of view or from a kind of quasi-scientific point of view in simplifying the alphabet.
Is that the basis for his dictionary as well? I mean, that's probably the thing that these days he is most famous for.
Well, Webster decided, I mean, it was pretty logical step when you think about it, that if you want to Americanize the language, one thing you want to do is codify American spellings or even introduce them. But the other thing you want to do is celebrate Americanisms. That is, not just new words that Americans invent, but new usages of old words that are common in the United States. And in Webster's day, that was very unfashionable. Americanisms were considered vulgarisms. They almost the way Ebonics is considered a substandard kind of speech today. I mean, maybe not as obviously not as racially tinged, but there's a certain kind of racial component to it. Americanisms were considered not proper speech. So words like skunk or caucus, words that we take for granted, lengthy, that most of Webster's contemporaries, elite members of early American society, considered gross barbarisms, just words that just were not, acceptable in proper company. Webster decided, all right, I'm going to write a dictionary and I'm going to include all these words because I want to celebrate anything that makes the English spoken in the United States different than English spoken in England. And one of those things that most makes the language different over the years are those new words and new usages of old words. So that's what led him to the dictionary, and it was really controversial plan to undertake when he announced it in 1800. And by the time he published his massive dictionary in 1828, he had pretty much convinced Americans that actually Americanisms were a good thing and that they ought to be celebrated.
You've talked about a number of different people in A is for American. One of the others who I wouldn't have realized until this was a contemporary of Webster's was Samuel Morse. He actually painted Webster's picture.
Yeah. Well, Morse was quite a bit younger than Webster. Webster's born in 1758 and Morse was born in 1791. But they knew each other through Morse's father, Jedediah Morse, who was a good friend and, in fact, a college classmate of Webster's. And Morse started his career really as a painter. Quite ambitious young man, went to train in Europe and very clearly sought fame and fortune in the United States. He wanted to sort of, in a way, bring to American art what Webster brought to the American language. He had a very passionate nationalist bent himself, and he found himself really disappointed. He happened in 1823 to paint Webster's portrait when Webster needed a portrait painted because he wanted a new, basically, author illustration for the dictionary that he was near finishing.
Which is funny because, in a way, Morse got what he wanted out of that, being remembered as a painter, even though nobody remembers that it was the same Morse as the Morse of Morse code.
Yeah, and I think Morse would be horrified to be remembered for portrait work, which is something he considered just the bare necessity for putting bread on the table.
Would he be happy to be remembered as the inventor of the Morse code?
Yeah, and Morse code is this wonderfully elegant invention. I mean, I think it's a kind of a beautiful idea to have that insight of the dot and dash rendering of the alphabet. What I found fascinating about Morse, and what I had no idea about before I began looking into his life, is that he didn't initially devise Morse code the way it ended up. He initially came up with a numerical code where he wrote his own dictionary, where he he basically arbitrarily assigned a number to every word in the language. And so to send a telegraph message, you'd have to look the word up in this dictionary. So let's say the word radio, and, well, radio would have been anachronistic. Let's say the word table, and it had the number 3248. And then you'd use the telegraph to communicate 3248 in dots and dashes. And someone at the other end would have to have the dictionary and use it like a Buck Rogers decoder ring to figure out what the message was. Which, when you think about how clumsy that mechanism is, it gives you all the more appreciation for how easy it is to use Morse code.
What happened? How did he get from one to the other?
Well, you know, he was no fool, that's for sure, and he realized how cumbersome the project was. When he devised the numerical code, he thought that the telegraph would be used only by the government for secret communiques. What Morse feared in the 1830s at the time he was working on this invention was that the Pope was leading a conspiracy to overtake the United States by importing Irish and German Catholics. So he had this pretty wacko conspiracy theory. I mean, it was wacko from our point of view, but in fact, it was somewhat commonly held notion in Morse's day that all this wave of foreign immigration was really about a Catholic conspiracy to destroy American democracy. So his idea about having the cipher be clandestine and classified for the government was partly about protecting the government from that kind of a conspiracy. I think he fell away a little bit from those views over time, and he also realized how inefficient this numerical code was.
I do want to kind of fast forward to modern times. You talk about Webster and how he was interested in nationalism. He wanted American phrasing. He wanted in his dictionary American idioms and American words. And the funny thing is now, here we are in a world of satellites and television, and in America now you're beginning to hear Britishisms sometimes. People talk about being in hospital instead of in the hospital. And somebody told me at the voicemail at the Smithsonian Folkways actually says, "Thank you for ringing us," instead of "thanks for calling," which is ours. What do you make of all of this? Are we becoming one worldwide English language now?
I think there's so many more opportunities for what Webster would have considered contamination of national language boundaries because of media, and just even thinking about the internet, but certainly since Alexander Graham Bell's telephone and since Morse's telegraph, the world is a smaller place, and those language boundaries, even within cultures that speak the same language but in different dialects, are just dwindling. I mean, there's the whole crisis of endangered languages all over the world because of the globalization of English and the globalization of other major languages. It's interesting to watch. I find it fascinating to watch. I don't find it as concerning as Noah Webster would have. I happen to think that in the United States, our multilingualism is a great strength, one that we don't take enough advantage of, but I think it's a tremendous strength. And I think looking at Noah Webster's life can remind us of the ways in which he was unable to see that during his lifetime.
Jill Lepore, talking about her new book, A is for American.